Yeah, Manuel.
If you look at the A's and C's as internal rhyme, mm-hmm. then there's a kind of rhyme with B and B rhyming as the second and fourth lines.
Say that again, sorry. If you,
but if you consider AA as right. actually part of one line and having internal rhyme,
oh, I see, okay.
And CC is another line.
All right.
And there is a kind of association right. with the B's and they
okay.
fit in.
All right, okay. That's interesting, because then it draws attention to the fact that you know, sort of rhyme play is one thing, and also the visual layout on the page is important for organizing. Yeah.
And Mountain Wells' observation gives us a ballad stanza.
A ballad stanza, yeah,
we
exactly.
We wind up with A, B, C, D.
Yeah, all right. So it's interesting. He's taken the ballad stanza and sort of taken it apart here to make a new form. Though
except
it doesn't work.
Far too long.
Except the lines are too long, and it doesn't you know sort of falls at the end. But I mean that's actually important. When we get to Lycidas, we'll see that how often in Milton's poetry, it's like ghosts of previous forms are haunting it. Donne is the same. I mean, Donne will not write in his erotic poetry sonnets. Yet every once in a while, you'll kind of feel that what Donne has done is has taken apart, dissected the sonnet, and used little bits of it to make something you know sort of new. And, you know, sort of here with Milton, I think we're getting something kind of similar that, you know, they're analogs with other forms or other ways of thinking about it. We're talking about, you know, sort of, just a little bit about unequal line lengths with Herbert. You know, the way in which Easter Wings uses the line lengths to convey the shrinking of the self. And I mentioned, too, when we had Johnson, if you could just put the B, the one before then, back up again, just to look at it visually. It's interesting that with Johnson, too, you have this kind of erratic, you know, sort of in and out. And that's quite common in different odes here, in different odes, you know, sort of the time, although Cowley doesn't do it as much. But I think... You know, it's also perhaps, Miranda, just to your point about the wildness, is that, you know, it creates a different kind of rhythm and effect here, that rather than the nice, tidy stanza form of this part, the second part, you know, seems to be, you know, sort of expanding and contracting a lot of the time, as if the poet is having a harder time controlling, too. Yeah.
In the Johnson, which is a little hard to see...
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the last five lines of the turn. It looks like we're going trimeter, tetrameter, pentameter, pentameter, pentameter.
Yeah.
What's really weird in Milton's hymn, mm-hmm. and as a modernist I do not like it, is the last three lines of his stanza, last four lines, let's say, are trimeter, pentameter, tetrameter, pentameter.
Yeah.
I can't think of any other poetic form where you have a trimeter next to a pentameter.
Yeah.
It's really odd.
Yeah. Okay, so just, I mean, sort of basic sort of point is that Milton seems to give us lines of more unequal lengths than you get in Johnson, that the gap between the lines is more. And I think that's actually kind of important here, is, you know, the unevenness of it, you know, especially in couplets that rhyme. You know, that we have couplets here, but one is short and one is long.
If you, I'm thinking about it in terms of rhythm and musicality, because in some ways, having the structure of the B where it is in the hymn, you get essentially a three against two. So you get a rhythm that's uncomfortable with the
okay.
triplets, like a AAB is the first triplet, CCB is the second, and then you get a couplet at the end. So you have a 3-3-2, which is.
And
you're trying to sing that
thing
in the choir or something, it's the hardest thing to feel.
Hmm,
it
that's
helps
interesting.
It's your natural rhythm of the line, and I think it does that here as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you read it, it just creates a rhythmic tension.
Oh, right, okay. And I think that that's kind of interesting to just again think that, you know, in a certain way, this is a poem, I would say, about tensions. You know, sort of on the surface, you know, one thing we have is a tension between the Christian and the pagan. That whole long thing about the pagan gods being sent away. Then we could think about the tension between the two parts, too, the first formal part and this kind of wilder part. But the larger issue, I think, too, is again the tension in Milton's mind of the subject, within the subject that he's dealing with. You know, sort of a god who is both the transcendent God and is part of the world. How can you imagine a divine God as a little baby? That's kind of the essence of it for him. And it is, you know, sort of an image that I think he finds really troubling. The basic problem, theologically, is one of incommensurability, is that you know, there's too big a gap between the human and the divine. And I think, in a way, the lines kind of work well that way, of having a more of a sense that the lines don't perfectly harmonize, that they don't fit, that he's not giving us the couplets that we'll associate with Pope or Dryden, you know, sort of later on, which are the perfect length in a sense of resolution here, that there isn't, you know, sort of that sense of complete closure that you would get from, you know, a rhyming couplet. Yes, I mean, you know, that's the other thing, is that, you know, sort of having the rhyming word sometimes in the middle of the stanza, you get a closure, and then you have to go on, too. So, John, yeah.
Oh, no, I'm just counting.
Okay. Sorry, that's not it. Michael,
did you... He's noticing this one, the last, the kind of counter rhythm at the beginning of the line. In both, you have a kind of anaphora. Here it's a it, and yeah. Of course, and, which sets up this kind of harmony in the beginning of the line that sometimes interacts or pulls away from the rhyme at the end, because you're connecting the beginnings of the lines.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's irregular, it's kind of random.
Right, okay.
So it kind of supports your point that there are connections, but a bit kind of disrupted.
But we always have to watch out. I mean, I think that's one thing with Milton's poetry that makes it very a complicated reading process, is that, I mean, even in the rhyme schemes, I mean, the fact is that, especially if you're used to reading a poet like Ben Jonson or other writers in the 17th century, when you start reading a poem and it has AA, your expectations in terms of the anticipation is that it's going to be in rhyming couplets. And with Milton, no, you can never trust, you know, sort of what's going to happen there. That, you know, the rhyme scheme can change. Now, this is more regular. Once he's said it, he continues. But that's actually a good, you know, sort of segue into Lycidas, I think, which is A11. You don't mind going to that. And the really complicated rhyme scheme there. Whoops, that's weird. You can take off B. All right. Just take B. Yeah, okay, great. Okay. So, as many of you know, this was a poem that was written as part of a commemorative volume of poems produced at Cambridge for a young student who, going home for the holiday, this sounds like a moral cautionary tale for all of you, going home for the holiday, was drowned in a shipwreck. So all of the students put together a volume of poetry. What? Sorry? I'm sorry, yes. He was going to Ireland, so it's, you know, sort of specific problem. But, okay, so Milton's, the rest of the poems are kind of interesting, you know, but Milton's obviously stands out as a classic. Here we need to think just a little bit about the context and the genre, that Milton is writing a pastoral elegy, and there's certain kinds of conventions in the genre here. It's a genre that itself is kind of bipartite. That it begins as a lamentation because someone has died, and then there's a pivotal moment in the middle in which there's a turn, so it becomes celebration. And it's interesting in relationship to what you were saying before, Brian, because the pivot comes in Lycidas through repetition, too. In line one, yet once more, O ye laurels, and once more, and then the pivot is in line 165, weep no more, O ye shepherds, weep no more. So you get a, you know, sort of repetition of the opening action, but now negated, so able to reverse it. Now, the other, you know, sort of formal properties associated with the pastoral elegy, of course, are things like the invocation of the muses, which follows after this, the procession of mourners, the questioning of the gods, you know, sort of how could something like this happen, you know, sort of stuff like that. So Milton is following, you know, kind of the conventions of the pastoral elegy. But with the rhyme, he's doing something fairly, you know, sort of original. Although it certainly has analogs, as critics have talked, with Italian canzoni of the time. You know, sort of that sort of free, you know, sort of rhyming verse that can go off in different directions. that this is a poem too that, as I said, you know, the Nativity Ode seems rather scattered. That, you know, sort of, as the verse perhaps kind of suggests, that it consists of different parts, and one of the questions is what holds them all together. As you know, those of you who've taken Milton know, one of my favorite descriptions of it comes from G. Wilson Knight, writing in 1939, you know, at the beginning of the war, when he saw a lot of young men going out to die, not in shipwrecks, well, some of them in shipwrecks, but, you know, sort of in war, and found the poem particularly moving and described it as, quote, an effort to bind together and clasp together a universe trying to fly off into separate bits. It is an accumulation of magnificent fragments. And I think that's just a fantastic description of it. And, you know, in many ways what Milton is trying on a simple level to convey is how death is shattering, how when anyone dies, we all have to put ourselves back together again. And the poem creates a kind of poetic crisis for Milton, too, which he feels that he has to put himself back together as a poet. Now, remember, this is the poem, too, that's in the last of the collection, that I said, that sort of marks for him a kind of pivotal point in his career. What we need to think about is the use of rhyme in the poem, in this binding process and kind of putting things together. The poem does rhyme, but the rhyming pattern is all over the place. It doesn't follow one set pattern. And again, I think that has the kind of unsettling effect that I was saying is typical of Milton's verse, is you never know exactly what's going to come next. There are also 10 unrhymed words. And if you want to know what they are, they're the first line, more, is unrhymed. Wind in line 13, 15 is well, shroud in line 22, caves in line 39, Lycidas in line 51, Jove in 82, 90, line 91 it's winds, and 92 it's swain, and 161 it's mountain. So they're scattered all over too, you can see, and you know, I've tried to think about sort of patterns of them, but you know, one thing you might think about is why does he have these rhymes that don't, you know, sort of fit in? Why does or have these words that don't rhyme? What's the effect of that? There are also moments too when it seems to kind of settle into patterns. Let's look at this opening here. So we start off with the A. Here's A is the troublemaker here, but because it just doesn't lead anywhere. And then we have B, C, C, B, an envelope rhyme, and then a couplet, and then sort of more sort of envelope. But see, the B keeps on coming back there. And then D, E, B, F, B. I mean, it's a really interesting kind of knotting of rhyming there. How might we read that? Just in itself, yeah, Nora?
I think it's an apt way to think about grief, circling back to the thing that you're thinking about, trying to move forward, and then ultimately returning to that need, that sort of that nexus of grief.
No, I think that's a great point to think about it in relationship to grief and a kind of coming back. Though it's also interesting, I mean, Milton writes sonnets, the Petrarchan sonnet, which also have a tendency to circle back because they use the same rhyme scheme over and over again. So there's a way in which he has got a kind of obsessive mind from the very start of, you know, once something gets into his head, he circles back to think about it. But I think here he's using that precisely there to suggest, you know, sort of an inability to move forward. I mean, I guess one of the things I've tried to draw attention in both the Nativity Ode and this poem is how often so much Milton's poetry has a tension between the poem sort of moving us forward and some force that's kind of pulling us back. And it sometimes is the bee. Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead, Louise. I was just thinking of how, and you know, also thinking about that rhyming scheme.
Yes.
How the rhyme wrote it well. It's interesting that these patterns work on levels that may not be perceptible or classifiable according to certain patterns of A-B-A-B, or
right.
anything, but they, like, it seems to almost indicate a pattern,
okay.
which isn't quite perceptible,
mm-hmm.
and I may be, like, imposing a reading based mm-hmm. on Paradise Lost, on
yeah.
these forms, but it does.
Well, it's interesting, because often people have, you know, sort of not even really noticed that it's written in, Lycidas is written in rhyme, because sometimes the rhymes are, they're never that far apart, but they're not always that obvious. And because they do keep on changing, so you're not able to have, I mean, in a way, you know, this is a poem which it's hard to have that feeling of anticipation that we like from rhyme. So it's almost as if it's frustrating some of the things that we want rhyme to do. Shandy, did you have a...
No.
Okay. Sorry, yeah.
It's also thematically, it's kind of like including how the sort of natural order and natural expectation is sort of disturbed by Lycidas' death.
All right, okay.
That order can't resume or continue the way that it previously was, or mm-hmm. by the disruption of the term.
Okay, I like that idea of sort of, you know, sort of rhyme being used, perhaps against rhyme again, to create a sense of disharmony. Or it's not, you know, it's trying to find patterns. You know, that Milton is trying to find patterns, trying to bind the world together. But the centrifugal energy that's pushing it apart is almost too strong. And then what?
It's not so much harmony as echo.
Okay,
You know, a beat that comes back way later.
Yes,
in
yeah.
Logic.
Yeah.
Grief is inevitable. Resolve.
Yeah.
Unexpected moments. It brings you back.
All right. That, I think, you know, that word, the sense of echo, I think, is a good one. To also come back to Nora's point about the sense of sort of returning. And it's interesting because, you know, one critic has tried to argue that the rhyming words do rhyme if you can remember them like 50 words apart. That rhyme that. Line 13 rhymes with line 131. There is this. But, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, sort of, I'm not sure if it's a sign of the critic's desire to try to find the, you know, sort of knit everything together, or a sense that maybe, you know, sort of the poem, they are supposed to rhyme, but they just, you know, they've been pulled apart by all the words that get in the middle of it. Yeah.
Just one more thing about the B.
Yeah.
It makes a unit out of these first 14 lines,
mm-hmm.
which they would
yes.
not otherwise
okay.
be.
Thank you.
And to quote the eminent Professor Kilgore, it's 14 lines.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if we should think about that at all.
That's the other thing I was going to say, that, you know, sort of Milton's poems often seem to be haunted by the ghosts of other poems. So, and I'm certainly not the first to have commented on this, but the 14 lines, if you read English, 14 lines, it must be a sonnet. You know, so that's programmed into us. But this isn't a sonnet. So, you know, so what do we make of that? Yeah.
That's a question that the students did for either rhyme or not rhyme, why would you not even half rhyme, is sort of sporadically wrong.
Yeah.
Very.
In fits and starts. It suits you.
And this is not somebody who's, generally careless.
Yeah.
This is clear as This is clear not, an accident or, it's like, oh, well, this will be the last one, people like,
Yes, no, I mean, it's interesting because in a way it does seem like, sort of careless and as a, but it obviously has to be very, very carefully crafted. So again, sort of makes us kind of think about, sort of what's the rhyming logic between these words too. And, I'm not sure how, sort of far we can go with that. I guess I'm more interested just in general is the way in which it does create a sense of trying to knit experience together to try to find some commonalities. In a world in which death as the force of division just seems to make that, so really, really difficult. Michael?
It's given the pastoral elegy context, people talk about it as kind of the B as a sort of ivy that keeps weaving back mm-hmm. around, or some kind of organic metaphor in a way, because the B comes back a little bit too, but it does feel like there's that sort of winding and you don't know exactly where it will return.
And I mean, I think, I hope, to a certain extent, I hope that was part of your experience of the poem, though not to the extent where you just felt completely, sort of lost in it all the time. But I think, sort of what Milton is trying to convey, I think, is again, sort of part of the consequence of death is a sense of his loss of direction. Doesn't, sort of death has left him kind of floundering. Where do I go? And, so much of the poem is about trying on different traditional conventions to see if they will give him the stability, which none of them are quite able to do until CD the end. Yeah, Miranda?
I just wanted to note something that I find myself playing in this poem and others. Is that I'm interested in how specific cues within the form of words guide the way that we respond to the sporadic or the not just the situation, the occasion, the grief, but for example, the constraint, the extent to which we then think about forms of formal constraint in certain terms as cued by, as steered by that phrase.
And interesting, you said a bitter constraint, sad occasion. The sad occasion is part of the bitter constraint.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, sort of, he's died, I have to write a poem of this
poem. So what it means is poem of constraint.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it sporadic then, because he wants to honor rhyme but not be constrained by
it? So in that local context, it takes a
Well, I think it also comes back to your point about mastery, though, too. It's, you know, sort of who's in control here, showing, you know, sort of how, I mean, I think, you know, sort of with rhyme especially, he's trying to, you know, sort of use it so that it's not a constraint, but rather something that's at his service. Yeah.
Well, one thing I was thinking of, too, is I just sort of spoilers, you go to the end to find out, you know, thus sang the uncouth swain, right? So, so I'm wondering if there's like a formative quality to this, that it's, the rhyme is, you know, irregular because it's displaying a kind of non-mastery, whereas the final stanza is regular, A, B, A, B, A, B, C, C, and it's sort of that, like, that was the uncouth swain speaking, and here comes, you know, sort of a different poetic speaker.
It seems to make the whole thing a sonnet, with the eight lines.
The resolution.
And everything.
Yes. Well, that's one way of looking at it. Okay, can we go to the very at the end? I'm not sure what slide it is.